Well, thank you very much, Chris, and thank you for the invitation. It's a delight to see so many familiar faces and old friends sitting in the audience. It's also a bit of a worry, because, as most of you know, I left the field of consumer policy as my daily bread and butter 7 months ago. And I suspect that whereas your expertise on consumer ADR has grown in those 7 months, mine has somewhat evaporated. I hope I'm not going to make any crass errors in what I'm about to tell you, but please give me your indulgence as somebody who has been away from the day-to-day operation of consumer policy for a while. Before I come, however, to the subject of the conference, I wanted to speak a little bit about, from the perspective of my new job. Now, this change of job is an interesting one. Those of you who are familiar with British political discourse will know that it's a particularly fascinating and challenging time to be representing the European Commission in the United Kingdom. Since the Prime Minister's Bloomberg speech, Europe, as a subject of political debate, has moved up the agenda, has come fully into the spotlight. And that means I've been involved in a lot of panel debates, discussions, conferences, which talk about the United Kingdom's place in Europe, the benefits which the European Union has brought to the United Kingdom, the disadvantages of the United Kingdom's membership of the European Union. But one thing that strikes me almost on a daily basis is, and this is true of whether you're talking to Eurosceptics, Europhobes, or Euroenthusiasts, is that there is a very low level of understanding of European policy and processes in this country. And when I took a step back and thought, well, why would this be? Is this true across Europe? And I don't think it is as true as it is in the United Kingdom. It occurred to me that one of the reasons why the British public and even British political circles find it so difficult to come to terms with the European Union is that the patterns and rhythms of the European institutions are very different, significantly different, from those that are familiar to us in Westminster, in the British Houses of Parliament. And so it's not so surprising, I think, that there is this degree of mutual incomprehension between the United Kingdom and the European Union institutions. One of the delights of my new job is that I get to go to all three party conferences. I was even willing to go to the UKIP party conference, but they didn't want us there. And one of the opposition front bench spokesmen on Monday said that there is a fundamental breakdown in communication between Westminster and the European Union. Now, is this just more fog in channel, Europe cut off? I don't think so. I think it's something to do, and it struck me when I was thinking about this conference, about the adversarial approach in the United Kingdom to many issues, and not just the adversarial nature of our legal system. If you think about the layout of our Houses of Parliament, we have front bench, opposition, two opposing sides sparring at question time. If you think even about our press and political interviewing, from John Humphreys on the Today programme in the morning to Paxman on Newsnight, it's very adversarial. It's very gladiatorial even. And the European Union adopts an entirely different approach to the way it goes about its business. It's geared to achieving compromise, ideally to achieving consensus, across a wide spectrum of political views. In fact, you have a kind of three-dimensional chess because you have the usual spectrum of political opinion, but you also have to feed in to that matrix the different national traditions, national backgrounds, national cultures. And the aim is always to reach an outcome which everyone can take away something. Maybe not perceive themselves as having triumphed in the debate, but they always go away with something that they feel they added to the process. And sometimes it's only pride or dignity that they walk away with. But that's very important, because when the next file comes along, the next proposal comes along, the coalition may shift quite fundamentally, so that the people you are arguing with this time are the people who are your strongest supporters next time. And even the vocabulary of European lawmaking echoes this. If you think about it, we talk about co-decision, the co-legislators, and the final stage is conciliation. And all of that, I think, has echoes of alternative dispute resolution. So perhaps it's no coincidence that this proposal came out of the European Union. Perhaps finally on this sort of musing, for those of you who are familiar with both Westminster and Brussels, you might like to think about parliamentary committees. Much of the work on legislation in Brussels is done in parliamentary committees. And you know, they echo the hemicycle. They sit in the same semicircular fashion, moving from left to right. The rapporteur will stand up and make their point. The shadow rapporteurs will equally stand up and make their interventions. And then, if you're sitting in the commission seat, you usually have the fairly comfortable possibility of responding to those interventions that you think are particularly helpful and carefully evading any of the points which have been rather difficult for you. Now, if you go to Westminster, and I've now accompanied a number of my commission colleagues to parliamentary scrutiny committees, it comes as a big shock to them. First of all, they arrive with a neatly drafted 3-page opening statement, and the first thing that the committee chairman will say to them is, "We don't do opening statements." So they take a big gulp and they wait for the first question. And what they get is, again, a kind of forensic examination. They're expected to reply time after time to very detailed questioning. And they often walk away. I think there is a feeling of mutual frustration. British MPs feel that they're not getting the answers they want, that there is obfuscation or evasion on the part of the Commission staff who appear before them. And the Commission staff walk away feeling that they weren't allowed to make their point, they weren't allowed to explain in detail the nature of the proposal or the nature of the course of action. So although all parties agree that part of the way of addressing the current unease about the European Union is to improve parliamentary scrutiny, I'm not convinced that that is without challenges in itself. Having said all that, I think it's quite interesting that one of the hypotheses upon which the ADR directive, the ODR regulation rests, is that there are other ways of solving problems than taking an issue to court, to the kind of arms race that often happens in the run-up to a legal procedure. And that some of those ways may relate more to conciliation, to reconciling two different interpretations of the facts. And what I want to do is talk a little about how the proposals emerged and how they were developed as an example of the way in which the European Union makes law, but which also, I think, will signal a recognition that there can be better ways of engineering markets for consumers than resorting to either heavy-handed regulation or significant legal redress measures. So, as Chris has already said, this proposal came out of the consumer portfolio of the European Commission. And the first thing I think I always said as a consumer policy, the director for consumer policy, was that in the eyes of the European Commission, consumer policy was not an anti-business policy. And I don't, and to be fair, I don't think it's generally regarded as an anti-business policy in the United Kingdom, though it is, I think, in some of the other member states, perhaps particularly those who made a more recent transition to a market economy. Our argument was always that we were pursuing a pro-market economy policy, a pro-market policy, because a properly functioning market is one which produces benefits for consumers and businesses alike. Proper competition produces quality, produces choice, produces optimal prices for consumers. And I think one of the keys to the success of this proposal is that although it came, as I said, out of the Consumer Commissioner's office, throughout we were very careful to associate business, particularly retailers and other service industries, with the development of our ideas. We tried to demonstrate that we listened carefully to their feedback and incorporated it in our work. And I think one of the strongest selling points was that the benefits that we proposed from consumer ADR, namely swift, effective, inexpensive resolution of disputes, are as beneficial to businesses, particularly the smaller businesses, as they are to consumers. The second thing I think I would like to say before I look at the proposal in detail is that both proposals, ADR and ODR, formed part of an overall vision of where we were going. They were part of a kind of program draft of measures, and in fact they fitted into a number of more schematic policies of the Commission. The first, the proposals were part of what was called the Single Market Act 1, there's since been a Single Market Act 2, which benefited from endorsement at the level of heads of government and heads of state, and also from the European Parliament. And it was in the Single Market Act that the commitment to fast-track these measures was made, which may explain why they went through the institutional process so quickly. But they were also part of the vision for the digital single market, the so-called digital agenda. Now, in this country, 80% of all consumers have made at least one online purchase, and there are other member states which have a comparable experience. But it does tailor off, I think, towards, for example, Romania and Bulgaria, where you're talking of less than 15% of consumers who have bought online. If you look, however, at the number of consumers who've bought from another member state, it remains stubbornly low. It has actually gone up quite significantly in the last year or so. But for most of the time I was dealing with consumer policy, it was stuck at just under the 10% mark, so 1 in 10 consumers. And when we sought to find out why people didn't want to buy from a website in another country, there are lots of reasons, of course, one of which is language. One of the chief of those was a fear of what would happen if something went wrong. How do you resolve your dispute, your difference with the online retailer? You don't want to go to the courts in that country. You don't even really want to pursue a French or a German or Italian website in the courts of your own country, because you may well suspect that enforcing any judgment would be extremely difficult and complicated. So the ADR, and more specifically the ODR proposals, the online dispute resolution proposals, were part of trying to make the digital single market, the online retail market, a reality, which it certainly wasn't when we started work on this. I think as well, and this comes out in the consumer agenda, we have lots of agendas. We like agendas and route maps and strategies and action plans. But in the consumer agenda, which actually came out after the ADR proposal was tabled, we also said that we saw redress as part of a panoply of measures which could help create a vibrant, well-functioning market and empower consumers. So redress is just part of the puzzle, and I suspect Chris will be saying something more about that. But in our conception as well, it sat alongside public enforcement, competition policy, self-regulation by businesses, consumer education as part of the toolbox that policymakers could use to ensure that the market functioned well and it produced benefits, those benefits for consumers and businesses. The next point I'd like to make is we try very hard and we don't always succeed. You may have heard that the UK government is challenging the bonus cap on bankers, for bankers, cap on bonus payments to bankers, because it was not assessed for impacts. Now that will be a very novel challenge. I think it will be interesting if that challenge succeeds, because it will be the first time, I think, that that will have been ruled a precondition for legitimate policy making. But we did try and make these proposals evidence-based. We collected a lot of data, and we continued to collect data, on the consumer experience in a whole range of markets, in goods markets and in services markets. And one figure which remained fairly consistent was that every year, between 1 in 5 and 1 in 6 consumers encounters a problem which they think deserves some kind of response from the trader. So it's serious enough not just to shrug off and say, oh, well, that apple was rotten, I'll throw it in the bin and I'll be more careful in my choice of apples next time. Something that really justifies you going back to the shop or to the service provider and asking them to offer some kind of compensation or curative action. Slightly more than half, I mean, actually 1 in 5, by the way, again, going back to this with fresh eyes, 1 in 5 strikes me as rather low. When you think of all the hundreds of thousands of contracts and transactions that we all enter into on a day-to-day basis, for only 1 in 5 of us to say, in the course of a year, I only encountered a problem that merited me actually remonstrating with the trader, means that on the whole, the service we're getting from retailers and others is not as bad as we sometimes think it might be. Of those who encounter such problems, about half actually complain. So people recognise that they have a complaint, that perhaps they should do something about it, but only half of them think it's worth their time and the effort of actually going back to the shop, going back to the plumber or the energy company and making a complaint. And of those who do complain, it starts to be like a funnel. Of those who do complain, about half get satisfaction. So the first port of call is naturally the empowered consumer takes action on their own behalf. The other half, the half that don't get satisfaction, generally give up at that point. So they make one attempt to solve a dispute with a consumer, with a trader, and then they give up. Some of them go to consumer advice, some of them report it to their consumer movement, some of them report it to a public enforcement body, but most of them just take the hit at that point. A very small percentage are willing to go to court, are willing to take the trader or the shop to court, but only if there is a significant sum involved. And for most people, that threshold is about €500. For anything less than that, the expense, the complication, the possibility of having to engage with the legal system or to engage with the legal profession is sufficient to put them off taking further action. The other thing that we did was we tried to estimate how much, therefore, of all these complaints which go not unnoticed, all these complaints which are not dealt with, which are not put right, how much that costs the consumer, how much detriment that amounts to in the average year. And we came up with a figure, and I won't bore you with the calculation, partly because I've forgotten what it was, but we came up with a figure of 0.4% of GDP, which is quite a significant amount of money, particularly when you hear people saying that the recovery from the current economic crisis has to be led in part by consumer spending. That 0.4% of GDP could have been better spent, could have been redistributed to responsible, responsive businesses. It could have rewarded the people who were behaving correctly and competitively. Instead, it just went into the pockets of those who had in some way or other failed their customers. So evidence-based policy making. And then consultative process. We tried very hard to include as many shades of opinion as possible in the consultations we carried out before tabling the proposal. And there was a consultative document, there was a hearing in cooperation with the European Parliament, and something which I think was very helpful to us, and there are one or two survivors from that process in the room, was that we worked on alternative dispute resolution in energy as a kind of microcosm, a testbed for ADR overall. And we did that in a multi-stakeholder group with national regulatory authorities, energy ministries, consumer associations, and national regulators. And we learned a lot about how ADR works in practice from that exercise. What the consultation showed us was that where ADR existed, it was generally prized and acknowledged to be a good thing. So of those companies who had used ADR, 71%, three quarters of them, were very happy with their experience, and even more would go back and try it again. Nearly four out of five said if they had another serious dispute with one of their customers, they would prefer to use ADR to any other form of dispute resolution. And that was also true of small and medium-sized enterprises, even though the knowledge and experience of ADR was very low amongst the smaller companies. So as a conclusion of that process of evidence gathering and consultation, we came up with a number of hypotheses. The first was that ADR is an effective way to provide consumer redress. It's a good way for dealing with disputes between traders and businesses on the one hand, and their customers or consumers on the other. The second thing we learnt was that there was an enormous variety of mechanisms, that ADR was not homogenous, that there were big differences between the member states, and that was a manifestation of their traditions, their history, their culture. So in some cases you had quite elaborate pyramidal organisations where you would have an overall ADR concept which was then conjugated in panels or boards or specific entities for each market sector, airlines, car hire, dry cleaning, energy, whatever. Some countries you had something we're familiar with in the United Kingdom, ombudsman. So you had a named individual supported by staff who would be responsible for resolving disputes in a particular sector. In some countries, you had very simple forms of conciliation. So you had consumers or consumer organisations or local chambers of trade whose job was a bit like marriage guidance, really. They would just bring the two parties together and get them to talk through their problems in the hope that resolution could be reached. But great variety of mechanisms. And they seem to work, largely. Not all of them. We had some concerns about quality, but in many cases, they seem to suit the lands in which they had grown up. But we were concerned that there was a very low level of awareness. Both consumers and businesses didn't really know very much about ADR, and that there were some big gaps. In some cases, the gaps were member state wide. There were some member states that had no real experience of ADR. In others, there were some sectors that were not served by ADR. So that was where we got to at the end of the consultation. And then we started thinking about drafting the proposal. And we came up, I think, we could reduce it to four things we wanted to achieve with the proposals. And they're quite simple. The first was that for every consumer transaction, whatever you were buying, whether it was goods or services, whether you were buying from a network industry or the corner shop, your local hairdresser or a big airline, for every consumer transaction, there should be available to you, in the case of a dispute, at least one ADR entity who could handle your difference with the trader. And that meant, essentially, we were talking about filling in the gaps. So as I said, the landscapes in the different member states were very different. But we took a decision at the very early stages that we were not going to go for one size fits all. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So if it worked, we would leave it in place, but we would set out a principle that all of the missing bits should be filled in. Secondly, we felt that to offer good dispute resolution, these entities needed to meet certain quality principles. And we had a basis for this because we had two non-binding recommendations, already tabled many years previously, which set out some of these quality principles. So that was our basis for looking at quality. Thirdly, we realized that it was very important to think of ways in which we could make consumers aware of the availability of ADR and businesses aware not only of the availability of ADR, but also to make them conscious that this is something that consumers would use to assert their rights to take matters into their own hands. And finally, we wanted to make ADR fit for the digital age. Some of these things had grown up 20, 30 years before, well before the internet came about. So that was our starting point. And if you look at the directive, and I guess most of you are now more familiar with the directive than certainly perhaps I remain, you'll see that first principle, that there should be an ADR for every consumer transaction, is set out at the very beginning of the directive. The next section then looks at quality principles. And it's quite interesting because, as I said, we took the initial quality principles from the existing recommendations. But if you compare the principles which appear in the final directive with the pre-existing recommendations, you'll see that they've been subtly evolved. And that was really as a result of the legislative process. We had drawn pretty much like for like, not exactly, from the recommendations. But a number of things happened in the course of discussion in council and debate in the parliament to change those principles. For example, if you look at the principle of accessibility, I think it's called access to ADR, the first one, there are a number now of procedural safeguards set out. Those essentially came from one member state, not entirely, but they were tabled largely by one member state, this member state, because it had a lot of experience with ombudsmen dealing with a vast number of cases, the Financial Services Ombudsman, the Energy Ombudsman, and they knew that, for example, it only made practical sense to deal with cases if there had been an attempt by the consumer, first of all, to revert to the trader. That sometimes you needed a threshold, otherwise you were overwhelmed with very trivial cases. That there are indeed vexatious clients, people who come back every week for another bite of the cherry, and there has to be some means of closing the door to frivolous and vexatious litigation or dispute settlement. So that section drew on a particular set of experiences and expertise. If you move on to the next principle, which is the expertise, independence, and impartiality of the ADR entity, there is a whole section which is probably impenetrable to most member states about the appointment procedures. And again, that was put in there specifically to deal with the case of Médiateur d'entreprise in France. Now, if you know the case, you know exactly how it fits around the Médiateur d'entreprise. For anybody else, you will probably spend quite a lot of time poring over that particular section, trying to work out how on earth it's supposed to be implemented in your own member state. When we come to the principle of transparency, I think it's important to notice two things. We're talking partly about transparency towards the parties. So the entity has to say to the parties, this is what you can expect from this procedure. This is how we're going to run the procedure for you. Are you going to end up with a recommendation? Are you going to end up with a binding decision? Can you call witnesses? How will we deal with you? Is it primarily by email or by telephone? Or will we expect you to come in person and explain your case to us? But the other part, and I think this is very important, is that there is transparency to the general public. So we have asked the ADR entities to be accountable, to publish annual reports. And that will enable, for example, consumer movements to take a look at the way ADR entities are performing and to, if necessary, point out those which may not be performing in the expected way. Those annual reports will also include recommendations, and I think this is the first sign you see in the directive, that in addition to providing solutions for individual disputes, we also see ADR as the ADR network as a means by which we can extract better data as to how the market functions and how, in particular, it misfunctions. So there is a provision in the article on transparency for ADR entities to make recommendations to trade bodies and to others about systemic problems, things they might need to change in their standard terms and conditions, things they might need to change in their marketing techniques, things that they might need to change in their in the way that they structure their tariffs. The other principles, and I won't go into them in detail, are effectiveness, fairness, liberty. So you can't bind yourself to go into ADR before the dispute arrives, and legality. And that last one's very important. Legality is a whole new provision which the European Parliament insisted upon. So if you're taken to an ADR, or if you go to an ADR entity, which produces a binding outcome, then as a consumer, you can be assured that you won't get less than you would have got had you gone to court. So that are the quality principles, addressing our second starting point. The next thing was to improve awareness of ADR. Now, I think in a way, to say there should be an ADR for every consumer transaction is a very good way of improving awareness. If everybody knows that somewhere you should have an ADR entity to whom you can turn, then you will start to look for it. If you're not sure whether there's an ADR or not, then it's not a natural consumer reflex to try and work out which ADR entity it will be. So in a way, simply the principle of having a complete coverage will help with awareness of ADR. I think, I have Christoph sitting on the front row, I think this was curiously the most difficult part of the directive to agree upon, the provisions on awareness and information to consumers. It was the very, you know, the clock was stopped at 5 minutes to midnight and we were still redrafting the provisions on information to consumers. And I think if we're honest, the Commission is probably not entirely satisfied with them. But we didn't come up with any convincing arguments to persuade the Council, or insufficient convincing arguments, or insufficiently convincing arguments, to persuade the Council and the Parliament to adopt our original proposals. So, traders will only be called upon to inform a consumer if they are committed to make use of ADR in the first instance. And then when the dispute arises, all traders will have to inform the consumer of the ADR entity which is competent to deal with the dispute. The idea is that consumers could make their choice in part on the basis of whether a trader announces that it commits to ADR. So a consumer could say, I prefer to go with airline A rather than airline B because I know that airline A will, in the event of something going wrong, it's announced its willingness to go to an ADR entity. And finally, making ADR fit for the digital age. This is the ODR resolution, the online dispute resolution regulation. And again, here you see the way in which the legislative process works. We had initially conceived this as being for cross-border online transactions. As it went through the legislative process, that became expanded and it's no longer limited to cross-border transactions. Because I think we were convinced by the argument that the consumer doesn't know whether they're indulging in an online transaction. If you buy from Amazon, you don't know whether your order will be fulfilled by Amazon UK, by Amazon France, or by Amazon Germany. And what you don't know, probably, is that in any case, the contract is made subject to the laws of Luxembourg. You know, if I'm in the UK and I buy from Amazon and it's delivered from an Amazon warehouse, does the fact that it's made subject to the laws of Luxembourg make it a cross-border transaction or not? So in the end, there was an expansion in the field of application of ODR. And again, we try to keep it as simple as possible. I'm not sure that in practice, and maybe Christoph tomorrow will be able to tell you more about this. In practice, it will be all that simple. But the idea is, it's again, a pyramidal construction. Once you have ADR entities offering full coverage in all of the member states, then the ODR platform sits on top of that and is essentially a switching mechanism. So it enables a consumer to come to the platform with their problem and to be redirected to the ADR entity in the appropriate member state with the appropriate jurisdiction, field of competence, and for there to be automatic translation and, if necessary, friendly assistance by intermediaries who will be able to explain both to the consumer but also to the ADR entity what the mutual expectations of the parties might be as to how they'll be treated, what rules they expect to apply, what kind of redress they expect to be offered. The onus here is very much on the Commission to build a platform which is user-friendly, which can be used intuitively by consumers, but also by businesses, because businesses may in certain circumstances take their disputes to the ODR platform, but also by ADR entities in the member states. In some member states, the ADR entities will be very small scale, very simple, as I've said, you know,
at the lowest level, it's one person working out of a local chamber of commerce, trying to bring parties together. So these will not all be sophisticated organisations, and they will have to be able to make use of the ODR platform in a way which makes them feel comfortable. So there are the four objectives we address and the four ways in which we sought to meet those objectives. As Chris has said, the two proposals were adopted in slightly more than a year, which is really quite surprising, quite amazing in the European context. I think the secret which any good gardener would share is in the preparation of the ground before we launched the proposals. We knew when we tabled the proposals what people were expecting, what they would be looking for. I think the partners, business and consumers, knew more or less what would be emerging. We had very good constructive cooperative cooperation throughout the process from the different stakeholders. Member states, I think, also brought their own experience and expertise to the table. And I think the proposals, the directive and the regulation, which were finally adopted, were certainly, and we should say so quite clearly, an improvement in substance on the proposal that the Commission put on the table. I do think the legibility might have suffered somewhere along the line. We were very proud of our drafting, and it did get a little mangled in the process. I do think these proposals, I don't know whether they're as fundamental as Christopher would like to think, but I do think they're exciting. They're a new way of looking at consumer policy. It's, I think, a modular approach to trying to make markets work. You have individual redress in the form of ADR. You have public enforcement, public bodies going after the rogue traders, going after the real systemic problems. You have competition policy making sure that businesses don't collude to the detriment of consumers. You have empowered consumers who either individually or through consumer movements exert soft pressure. You have consumer education, which should help young consumers and even older consumers to make good choices. And you have other things that may be added on in certain circumstances, such as compulsory insurance funds, which you have, for example, in some of the travel sectors. It's modular, and it can be modulated to suit the sector, to suit the state of development of a particular market, and to suit the expectations of people in a particular member state. What surprised me is, I was closely involved. What surprised me is it got very little discussion in the popular press. This is something that the European Union is doing for every single member of the European population. Everyone, sooner or later, is a consumer. Sooner or later, in the course of 5 years, you're going to encounter a problem statistically. And yet it got very little talked about. And partly we have this problem that adoption is not coming into force. But I think there are challenges ahead in terms of implementation. You're going to be talking about that over the next day or so. But the other key challenge will be to make sure that people understand what is changing, what is happening, and the new opportunities that these proposals should offer them if they're properly implemented and applied. Thank you very much.